So this week I will give three lectures in total. So and all the lectures will be about Dirac fermions and its relation to the topology of physics. As you will say, that's actually a connection is very natural. That's why I try to also present it in this way. And the connection of Dirac fermions to what I talked about last week is that indeed at the critical point, indeed if you look at, let's say, the solution of the transverse Eisenvoet model in the language of Jordan-Wigner fermions, there the structure, let's say the band structure and also the Hamiltonian is indeed very similar to the Dirac fermions I'm going to talk about this week. And probably the only difference is that for those Jordan-Wigner fermions, they are Majorana fermions, or in sometimes people call them real fermions. And here, what I'm going to consider is complex fermions. That's probably the only difference. And also for this Dirac fermion, if you consider a gapless, massless Dirac fermions, it's actually also a CFT. It's probably the simplest CFT because it's free. And then a lot of things that I have discussed about CFT conformal symmetries also apply to the Dirac fermions when the mass is zero. Okay, so that is the plan of this week. So for the topology of physics, I will, for example, talk about solitons or fractional charge in 1D. Or zero mode, and then I will also talk about what we called a Chern insulator, and also what is related to what is Chern number. So as you will see, it's actually very natural stems from the story of Dirac fermions. All right, so let's start with Dirac fermions. The first thing that I want to do is that just remind you of what is Dirac fermions in quantum field theories. And then you can say how does it naturally appears in the context of quantum matter. So just first, let's start with the, I guess you have learned Dirac fermions in or Dirac equations in the QFT course, right? So let's start with the Dirac equation. Right. So the idea of the Dirac equation or Dirac fermions is that you're going to use some what we call the spinner to represent the fermionic degree of freedom. And then you can write down the Dirac equation. And those gamma are what we call the gamma matrix. And the key property of the gamma matrix is that they are anti-commuting, right? And you can also write the and usually we also define something we call the psi bar, that is just psi dagger gamma zero, and then you can write down the Lagrangian of the Dirac fermions it's like this. And you probably saw this notation before, right? This slash partial is just correspond to this gamma mu contracts with partial mu, right? That is what we learned in QFT course. And in condensed matter, usually when we think about, when people talk about Dirac fermions in QFT, people, at least in textbook, they usually deal with the case of four space-time dimensions, right? And here, indeed, in condensed matter, sometimes we deal with two space-time dimensions, and also three space-time dimensions. And that's also what I'm going to do in lectures. So let's first think about the Fermilian case, let's say four space-time dimensions. And then we have, in total, four gamma matrix, right? Let's say gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma. So, and those gamma matrix are like 4 by 4 matrix, right? And then the spinner, this psi are also a four component vector, right? And then you can write down you can write down the anti-commuting for gamma matrices by, for example, using do tensor product of the poly matrix, right? You can find that in textbook of QFT. I will not repeat that. As I said, what we are going to consider are mainly three space-time dimensions and also two space-time dimensions. In 3D, what we're going to have are three poly matrices, right? And then you don't need to go with 4x4 matrix to do that, and you can just have it by 2x2 matrix. And you can just choose those three matrices to be poly matrices, right? Sigma x, y, z. They naturally satisfy this anti-commuting relations. And then you can just use that to define Dirac fermions, right? And naturally, in this case, those spinner psi are just like two component vector, right? And in 2D, the situation is very similar, that I can just use 2x2 matrix to write down the gamma matrix, because yeah, I just need two anti-commuting matrices, right? And then we can just choose two of those gamma matrix, those poly matrix to write down my gamma matrix, right? That's the, that's how you can think of Dirac fermions in the language of QFT for different dimensions. And just, you probably know that, probably heard that, indeed that's related to the so-called spinner representations of SOD, right? SOD is your space-time Lorentz symmetry, right? And yeah, there's some funny, like even odd effect, like if you want to consider 5D Dirac fermions, it turns out that you can also play with 4x4 matrix, right? But if you go to six dimensions, then you have to do 8x8 matrices and so on. Yeah, but we will not go to that high dimensions. We just will focus on those two cases where you already see this. Even an odd effect, I'm always able to use 2x2 matrices to write down the gamma matrix for Dirac fermions. Okay, with this Lagrangian, we can also get his Hamiltonian, right? And Hamiltonian is what we are going to play with in these lectures. And also, you know, in condensed matter, we usually play with Hamiltonians. So doing the usual, So I will not show how to get Hamiltonian from Lagrangian. It's a very standard thing. So in the end, you end up with a Lagrangian Hamiltonian that is looks like psi dagger gamma zero and times minus I gamma a partial a and plus a mass term times psi. And here a rounds from 1 to d minus 1, right? So that is the Hamiltonian formulation for Dirac fermions. And you can also write it in the momentum space. It should be d minus 1. You can write it in the momentum space. So here I'm writing it in the real space. You can go to the momentum space and it becomes minus I gamma A KA plus M and psi K, right? That is the Hamiltonian, right, for Dirac fermions in arbitrary dimensions. So again, back to the concrete case that I'm considering 2D and 3D, we can write it in a more concrete way that say we consider 3D, and then we can choose our gamma matrix to be, let's say, gamma 0 equal to sigma z, and gamma 1 equals to minus sigma y, and gamma 2 equal to sigma x, right? So remember that we just need to make sure that all the gamma matrix anti-commute, that's it. And then my Hamiltonian becomes HK equals to psi K dagger. I'm just writing its K component. In the end, you need to integrate over K. And it's psi K dagger times KX sigma X and plus KY sigma Y and plus M sigma Z psi, right? That's my Hamiltonian for 3D. And then you can easily get its spectrum by diagonalizing this 2x2 matrix, right? And since all the polymetrics are anti-commuting, then you immediately get its spectrum to be plus and minus, or minus root of kx squared plus ky squared plus m squared, right? So we recover the spectrum of the energy of Dirac fermions in QFT, right? So that is a 3D story, and then and in 2D it's very similar. That let's say we can choose gamma zero to be sigma x, and gamma one to be sigma y, and then my HK will be psi k dagger k sigma z. So in this 2D, by 2D is actually really mean 1 plus 1D, right? 1D, 1 is my space-time dimensions, space dimension, and the other one is the real dimension, time directions, right? So then I just have a moment, the momentum is just along one direction, right? And my Hamiltonian becomes just like this. Sorry, it's m sigma x, right? And then you can again get its spectrum simply because those two matrices are anti-commuting. You can easily diagonalize them, and then you get it's plus or minus root of k squared plus m squared, right? That is the Hamiltonian for the Dirac fermions in the context of QFT. So one thing you can notice is that if m equal to zero, right, then my spectrum is gapless. While m is finite, then I have a finite gap, and the gap it will be proportional to m. It will be just m, right?
Listen.
Yeah.
When shouldn't there be a sigma z multiplying? I see you multiplied m with sigma z, but why not the? Did you use some commutation relations there or something?
Which line are you talking about?
So from the second line to the third line.
Yeah.
There's a gamma zero multiplying the parenthesis.
Yeah.
So where did the sigma z go? I see it multiplying m, but not the.
So here, for example. If you consider the first component,
sigma y, okay.
Yeah. It's minus sigma y. Yeah, that's why.
Shouldn't there be like a ky sigma x in the Hamiltonian?
No. Because for kx, right, I have gamma 0 times gamma 1, I gamma 0 times gamma, minus I gamma 1. Yeah. And then.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe I mess up some sign, but yeah, you get the.
Okay, I
see.
So it's k sigma.
So when m equal to zero, right? The theory is gapless. Dirac theory is gapless, and indeed, it's a CFT. and T is a safety. It's a free safety, meaning that there's no interactions, and it's true for any dimensions. And indeed, as far as scaling dimension is concerned, for example, for the scaling dimension of psi, the fermions will be d minus 1 over 2. You can easily get it by just dual power counting, right? Like here, right? It's very simple, right? So, But this lecture will not really, we're not about CFT anymore. So I'm just pointing out this fact to make a connection to the what I taught about last week. All right, so that is the Dirac theory in the QFT. So now we are going to say how we get those Dirac fermions in the context of quantum matter systems. Again, I will start by just playing with models and then to say why we can get Dirac fermions there. So I will start with 1 plus 1d Dirac fermions. So one realization of 1 plus 1d Dirac fermion is actually very simple. That is, we just consider 1d fermionic chain, a quantum fermionic chain, where I have fermions. I have a lattice from a 1D chain, and then I have fermions hopping on them. It's very similar to the to the Jordan-Wigner for the transversalizing model. Once you do a Jordan-Wigner transformation, you end up with some fermions moving on the 1D chain. Here, the example that I'm talking about is very similar, except that I'm now preserving the particle conservations. I don't have term like C dagger. It's just hopping, right? So that is the Hamiltonian, and I'm considering a case that let's say a periodic boundary conditions. I'm putting it on a periodic chain, and then I have this periodic boundary conditions, and then I consider a case of what we usually call half filling, meaning that the total particle numbers will be the half of my lattice size, number of lattice size, right? I'm just fill half of the available states in this fermions, in this fermionic system. Okay, so that is the Hamiltonian. And then as you can probably easily tell that to solve this Hamiltonian, we can go to the momentum space but introduce the fermions in momentum space just doing it by doing a Fourier transformation for the fermions on each side. And then I can solve this Hamiltonian, or the other way around is that I can, the inverse of this transformation is say J equals to 1 over root L, and I'm sum over all the momentum K whereas and the exponential I k times j and c k, right? So this is a Fourier transformation, and then we can use it to solve the this 1D tight bonding model. And so it's very straightforward to work out what we get in the momentum space. The Hamiltonian becomes minus sum of summation of over k with two cosine k, ck dagger, and ck, right? Yeah, it's much simpler than the transverse Ising model story. And here, the k will be quantized by taking values of 2 and pi over L with n running from, let's say, minus 2L to 0 and times L over 2 minus 1, right? Again, I'm just consider a case that I have an even number of sites. OK. So and then you can plot this the band this its band structure, right? It's just the energy is just 2 cosine k. You can plot it. Let's say it's my k momentum, and then that is my energy, right? And then the spectrum basically look like this. And let's say with k running from pi to minus pi, and what's special is here that k equal to minus half pi and half pi, right? So remember that I'm considering the case that I half fill the system. That means I'm going to fill half of the variable states, right? And in momentum space, the game is really that I just fill a state at different moment, right? So then what I'm for the ground state, what I'm going to do is that I'm start to fill the state with lowest energy, right? That will be the state at the bottom of my band, right? And then I start to fill them until I fill all the available states. And you can easily convince yourself that when I precisely fill the state between minus half pi to half pi, I happens to half fill of the available states. That means my ground state will be just be the state with all the fermions here filled, right? With all other fermions empty, right? So and then you can start to ask, what about the excited state, right? If I want to excite some excitations, what I'm going to do is that the low energy excitations will happen at those two nodal points, right? Because they are the around this nodal point, we get the empty state will have lowest energy, right? So then my excitations will be, for example, I can start to throw fermions near the nodal point, and that gives me the low line excitations. So now we can ask, what does those what does the energy of those low line excitations look like? And you can you can easily show that, let's say my energy, right, epsilon p plus or minus pi, right, that say we create an excitation with the momentum p plus 2 pi or p minus 2 pi, that's really correspond to that and create excitations here or here, right, near my two nodal point. And then you can easily find that the energy will be just proportional to my momentum, right? This p, right? It's like the difference of my momentum from the momentum at the nodal point, right? And that actually gives me a correspond to the case of this Dirac Hamiltonians or Dirac energy spectrums with m equal to 0. Right there, I also get linear dispersions where the energy is proportional to my momentum. Here, it's also the case, right? But the difference is that there's some shift of my momentum, lattice momentums, right? Because my nodal point sitting at the plus and minus half pi of my lattice momentum, right? So now you can then we can redefine then we can just focus at the excitations are near my nodal point, right, then they will be well approximated by Dirac fermions, right, because simply because their energies are linear with respect to P. And in particular, when we consider the very large system size limit, that means that L much larger than 1. So this approximation is very good. It's almost exact. And then we also get infinite number of excitations just near the nodal point. So, and then we introduce fermions that we usually call right fermions and left fermions. That's really just that I'm now going to call excitations near those two nodal points as my left fermions and right fermions. So the right fermions is defined by I'm considering excitations or fermions near the 2 pi nodal point, and left fermion is defined by the fermions at the minus 2 pi nodal point, right? And I'm also shifted the momentum, right? I'm redefining my momentum just as p, right? Rather than using its crystal momentum, right? So then we can, with this, and then we can just try to write down the effective Hamiltonian that describes the excitation near nodal point, or in other words, describes how fermions, left fermions and right fermions describe their dynamics. And then, so in practice, it's also very easy to do so by just expanding this cosine k near plus pi and minus pi. And we get, that'd be a little bit slower. So we just consider excitations near those two nodal points, and I get for the right fermions, I get its energy is 2 times cosine 2 pi plus p. And similarly, for the left moving fermions, its energy is 2 times cosine minus 2 pi over 2 plus p. And psi L dagger p times psi L p, right? That's my effective Hamiltonian. And then I made a further approximation that I'm considering the small p limit. And then I can just rewrite it as some linear dispersions and then it becomes summation over p. So now I'm really considering the case that p is much smaller than 1. And it's 2p times psi r dagger psi r. I'm here, I'm omitting this momentum k here. But remember that those fermions has a finite momentum p. And then my effective Hamiltonian really just becomes in this form. And you can also rewrite it as, let me just write it as summation of p and times 2p psi r dagger psi l dagger sigma z psi r psi l, right? Now I'm recovering the Hamiltonian of the 2D Dirac fermions with m equal to 0, right? Yeah. So and here you see that the Dirac fermions actually has two components, right? This psi left, psi right, and psi left, and physically they really correspond to the mode at one at this half pi near the half pi, and the other near the minus half pi. It's kind of like that we kind of like bring those together, right? And we make a dual cone, bring those two together by shifting their momentum, the convention of their momentum, then we get dual cones, and then the two components correspond to the modes at different lattice momentum, right? So, and let me just write explicitly that the psi is really just now is this left and right fermions that they form the two component Dirac spinners. And mass is zero. Okay, so that's how we get the Dirac fermions. And indeed, you can play the similar game for the transverse Ising model that I talk about, and then you can get something similar, except that there you want to play with real fermions or Majorana fermions instead of complex fermions. Okay, so that is the how we get massless Dirac fermions. So then a very natural question is that how to add a mass to it, right? Or yeah, and to make it massive. So then we can think about the mass of the Dirac fermions, right? So the mass is very simple in terms of language of gamma matrix, right? So simply that is that I can, as long as I have some a term that it can be written as a gamma matrix, poly matrix that anti-commuting with sigma z, right? It will play the role of a mass in the sense that my spectrum now will become massive, right? So then there are two types of mass you can introduce, right? One type of mass is that psi dagger. Sigma x psi, right? And the other mass is psi dagger sigma y psi, right? And those two poly matrices are anti-commuting with sigma z, right? As I said, then they will play the role of the mass, right? And you can of course write it more explicitly, then it will behave like psi r dagger times psi l plus psi l dagger psi r, and the other mass will be I times psi r dagger minus I times and plus I psi l dagger psi r, right? So those are the two possible masses we can add to the Dirac Hamiltonians, right? In principle, right? And physically, they really correspond to the scattering between those two nodal point, right? As by just, yeah, you can just say that by looking at what does those terms look like. Okay. So then it's very so then you can ask the question that under what conditions or under what situations those mass term will show up, right? And so one way to do that is not a clever way, is that now I just start to add more terms to my Hamiltonian to say, and then repeat the same game to say that what do I get in the end, right? To say whether I can get some terms like this, right? Of course, and then there's like many different terms you can add. It's not clear that what's the best choice, right? So then a very powerful way to understand what does those mass correspond to and how to turn them on is to understand the symmetries of the model, so which I will explain right now. And the key is that we want to the key in this story is a translation symmetry. So now we will say that indeed, as long as my system preserves translation symmetry, those two masses cannot be added on to my Hamiltonian. In other words, I will always have gapless Dirac fermions. So let's see how this happens. So we'll just think about, now we start to think about symmetries, and in particular, we will focus on translation symmetries. So, So in my lattice model, right, I have translation symmetry by just moving my system by one lattice spacing, right? Apparently the Hamiltonian doesn't change, right? And that translates to and then you can ask how does those translation symmetries act on my fermions, right? Left fermions and right fermions, and also how does it act on this two-component Dirac spinner, right? So we can first, let's say, we just ask how does the left fermions translate, right? So then it's actually very easy to figure out, because remember that the definition of my those left and the right fermions, they really correspond to my fermions, original fermions at a certain momentum, right? Then you can easily figure out, then directly follows from that I have, if I consider translation of my left fermions, I will just get a phase factor, which is its original momentum, right? The momentum of the original fermions at the first place, right? Here I'm considering the fermions at p, right? Because the p here is actually gets shifted in my definition, right? Right. So that's why I get this momentum, and then it equals to I times exponential minus ip phi l, right? And similarly, we can work out how does the right fermions transform under my one lattice translation. And that becomes minus I exponential IP psi r, right? Yeah, the reason that I get a minus I rather than a plus I, because they are this right fermion are sitting at a different lattice momentum, right? Here is sitting at minus pi over 2, and here the right fermion is sitting at a p plus pi over 2, right? That's why I get different phase factors, I. So then for this two-component Dirac spinners, we can know that it transforms like I times sigma z exponential minus ip. Right. So that is how I transform, and then we can easily figure out that for both mass terms, they are actually change sign as I consider this one lattice translation. Right. If I consider the mass with sigma x, it will transform as psi dagger exponential ip times minus I sigma z times sigma x times I sigma z exponential minus ip psi, right? And then just using the commutation relations of Pauli matrix, then we end up with minus psi dagger sigma x psi, right? So that means if I preserve translation symmetry, then I'm not able to add this mass term to my Hamiltonian, right? And similarly, for the mass of sigma y psi, so it's also transformed the same as sigma x mass, right? Simply because sigma z anticommutes with either sigma x or sigma y, right? That's why I get minus I here. So that also tells me that I cannot add this term to my Hamiltonian as long as the translation symmetry is preserved, right? So, and this is also an example that the symmetry could preserve the gaplessness of the system, and is actually pretty generic in many different quantum matter systems. When you play with gapless theories like Dirac fermions or some other, more formally speaking, conformal field theories. And with this information, we can also easily tell that if I want to gap out my Dirac fermions, what you need to do is to break the translation symmetry, right? So then physically, you can easily come up with the terms that break the translation symmetry, right? One is that now I'm turning on a staggered hopping, for example, a staggered hopping that whose psi depends on the number of site, right? And then this breaks the translation symmetry, right? And then you can show that this term indeed, again, you can repeat this the analysis here by adding this actual perturbation. Then you can show that actually I will get an actual max term, and then my spectrum becomes massive, right? And the gap is opened near my two nodal point plus or minus half pi, right? I don't quite remember which mass it does correspond to, but it can easily work it out. I think it's probably sigma x, but I might be wrong. So and the other type of term you can consider is that, for example, now I'm just adding an on-site potentials, right? I can add an staggered potentials, which again breaks the translation symmetries, and then you can also work it out that it corresponds to some mass, right? And pictorially, what does it's also kind of intuitive to understand why those two terms can help you to gap out Dirac fermions. Right. You can think the extreme limit that, let's say, if I consider the first type of perturbations, right, you can think of if it's turned on to be very strong, then I can kind of form dimers between, let's say, the first and second site, and third and fourth site, and so on. Right, that certainly is a gapped phase. Right. And for this case, again, you consider the extreme limit, then you will get, let's say, I will have fermions occupied, let's say, at even size, right, and so on, right? Again, it's a massive phase that the fermions doesn't get moved, right? Those are the intuitive way to think about what are those two actual perturbations correspond to, right? Sometimes such pictorial argument or may not be correct. So then, to really figure out whether those terms would break gap out of my Dirac fermions, the right way to do is really go with a symmetry analysis and then figure out what is happening. Okay, so that is a story about how we get Dirac fermions, 2D or 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions, just in a lattice model, in a lattice model, and it's really just a simple tight bonding model, and it's a very nice an example that how we get those concept and NKFT emergent in concrete and simple lattice models. And historically, one really motivation to study such models is actually it can describe some materials that people have been worked on quite a lot and in the past. And one particular materials is that is some organic polymer and the model related to this is called Sue Schaefer and Heger model. In 1979, it's a pretty old paper, and right now there are still a lot of activities trying to study this similar physics in different contexts. And one very fascinating properties of this model, as well as the materials. For both materials and models, is that indeed in these Dirac systems, there exists some very special type of excitations that are called soliton excitation. And it's some topological excitations. And it has a number of interesting properties. And one interesting property is that those solitons has a fractional charge. Precisely, the fermion charge is 1/2 trapped at the soliton, and that has been observed experimentally in those so-called organic polymers, and that's why in the past there are a lot of very interest in studying this 1D Dirac fermions. So, and in the rest 10 minutes ish, I will give you a brief idea about what this soliton solution is, and it also connects very deeply to a topology that is called. Singer index, so yeah, if you're interested, you can check some you can try to find it online, so yeah, and later I will also give you some reference to read for these stories about solitons and the fractional charge, also how is it related to the organic polymer in real materials. All right, so let me try to explain what is this soliton story in this Dirac fermion context. So for this soliton story, what you consider is now I'm considering the case that my Dirac fermions has a mass, right? But the mass can have a non-trivial profile, meaning that the value of my mass will be proportional to the the value of the mass will depend on the positions, right? So we consider this Hamiltonian, right? Here I'm using the first quantized language to think about Hamiltonians, right? That's the first term again just the kinetic term for Dirac fermions. Then I'm adding the mass term, right, for the Dirac fermions. And now the key is that now I'm considering the case that the mass can depend on the position of the of my space, 1D space. And then in particular, I'm going to consider a situation that the mass actually changes sign, let's say at x equal to 0. That's why it's called a soliton, that in the both x equals to minus infinity and infinity limit, it approaches some constant, but let's say at x equal to 0, then it changes sign, right? That's the problem we are going to consider, right? If you, yeah, So that's why people call it a soliton or a kink, right? So you can think this shape is a kink, right? And then you can actually move it without causing too much, right? As long as you don't deform those two limit, right? So then the key in this story is that you just want to consider what are the possible excitations for this Hamiltonian. And in particular, so you can easily imagine that you have some solutions with very high energies, such that whose energy is much higher than my mass, right? Then this mass is just negligible. Then approximately, I just get the usual solutions of Dirac fermions. And those solutions will be extended solutions, meaning that they will have some momentums. They can propagate to infinite far away, right? Those are the usual plane wave solutions for Dirac fermions. But the interesting thing is that there will be some localized excitations, will be localized just near this kink. And those are the what people called domain wall solutions, soliton solutions. And it was first worked out by Jakiv and Rabi in 1976. And the way to think of it is really just that, just ask the question that now we want to solve this Dirac equations, right? Now consider first the quantized Dirac equations. That's really just a Schrodinger equations, right? And we want to solve equations like this, right? This psi just some two component vector, and then I'm doing a very brute approximation that is I'm just assuming that I get for x larger than zero I get a constant mass, and for x smaller than zero I get another mass, right? And here as I said, we will consider a case that the mass changes psi. That means that M1 is larger than zero, M2 is larger, smaller than zero. But at the moment, that's just a trait them as a different mass, M1 and M2, right? So that is a problem we want to consider. And then the goal is to ask what kind of solutions can we have for these Dirac equations? And in particular, we want to look for some localized excitations whose wave functions will be just localized near the this kink. Okay, so then, and then what we can do is that we just make an ansatz. Let's say my wave function looks like when x larger than zero, it will be something like, let's say, psi one plus psi two plus, and with an exponential minus lambda x, right? And let's say for x smaller than zero, the wave function will be phi one minus, phi two minus, and exponential lambda minus x, right? Let's say we make an ansatz, right? For say I have this solution, and the key is that first of all, those two-component vector phi does not depend on x. They are just constant, right? And secondly, it has this exponential factor. And here I'm considering, so I want to consider a localized solution. Then that means those lambda plus and lambda minus should be some positive real number. So then it will just exponential decay very far away, and all the most wave functions will just be localized near this kink, right? So you may think that this answer is too naive, right? In the end, I may not have a solution that satisfies these relations. But it turns out that indeed this answer is already good enough that I can get exact eigen solutions for this Hamiltonian. And you can let me quickly go through it. You can also easily try to work it out by yourself. So that's just first apply this multiply hx to my psi x with x larger than 0. And then it will become a lambda plus m1 I lambda plus n times psi 1 plus psi 2 plus and times exponential lambda plus times x, right? It's very straightforward that you just get this, right? And remember that here I'm assuming that phi 1 and phi 2 are just x independent, right? And then just follow this eigensolutions. It should equal to E times phi 1 plus phi 2 plus, right, exponential I lambda, right? Sorry, there's no I here, right? Get this. So then you can solve what E will be and what this phi 1 and phi 2 will be. So you can easily get that E squared equals to M1 squared minus lambda plus square, right? It's just 2x2 matrix. You can diagonalize it. Yeah, you can play it with Mathematica later to convince yourself that's the case. And then remember that we want a solution that lambda plus is positive, is real, right? And positive, then lambda plus is real if E is smaller than M1, right? So that is also, and physically that also makes sense, right? You can think that M, the mass, is, you can think this as an energy barrier, right? Then if you consider a solution that whose energy is very high, then you will not get a localized state. But if the energy is very small, much smaller than my mass, then you will get some localized state, right? You cannot propagate infinitely far away with finite probability, right? That's the physical meaning of this solution. And then you can also get phi 1 plus phi 2 plus will be proportional. That's by meaning proportional because I'm not trying to normalize this solution. It will be m1 over I e plus I times m1 squared minus e squared, right, and 1. Yeah, that's the solution. And then you can also, similarly, you can also get the solution for the x smaller than 0. Right, it's very similar that you get e squared equals m2 squared minus 1 squared, and then you get the solution of this by simply replacing m1 with m2. Right, that's the solution for phi 1 minus phi 2 minus, right? And then the final condition that we have is that those two solutions, right, they should be the same at x equal to 0, right? And that is saying that this those two component vectors should be the same. And then by simply staring at these solutions, you can end up by saying that I need, because I'm here, I need this to, in order to have it to be a localized state, right? This guy should, the guy inside, this root m squared minus e squared should be real, right? Simply because it's really just this lambda plus and lambda minus. And then to make those solutions the same at x equal to 0, we need e over m1 equals to e over m2, right? And then there are two solutions for that, right? One solution is trivially that M1 equals to M2, right? This is one solution. And the other solution is that E equal to 0, right? If E equal to 0, then you will find that those two are also trivially satisfied. And then indeed, if you think a little bit harder, this solution won't give you the correct answer, because there's an actual condition that is this those lambda plus and lambda minus to be positive. And it turns out that this solution is not satisfy that. I don't have time to explain, but you can play it with yourself. And this solution is kind of trivial, right? But then the really interesting solution is that this solution, right? It happens precisely at E equal to 0, right? And once this is true, then this all the relations is satisfied non-trivially. And this solution exists only if M1, M2 is smaller than 0, that they have different sign. And again, that comes from the requirement that this lambda plus and lambda minus to be positive, right? So and one funny situation is that once this M1 and M2 has a different sign, I will always have the same solution, right? Equal to 0, and then the wave function will be just and the wave function will really just be I and a two component vector with I and 1 and times the that's my final solutions, right? Yeah, so that's my final solutions. And again, it's independent of what are the precise value of this M1 and M2. Yeah, so it's indeed very interesting, right? Because in the end, I get a solution with exactly zero energy, regardless what's the value of M1 and M2, as long as they have opposite sign, right? And this is what people call zero mode. And it's indeed robust regardless how you deform this mass term. Here I'm considering some simplified case that the mass is constant, right, at the at plus and minus. But in the end, you can also have a situation that it has some profile as long as it crosses zero somewhere, and then there will be a zero mode. Yeah. Here I won't prove it for you, but you already kind of get the sense of it by realizing the fact that I always get zero mode regardless of the value of M1, M2, right? And deeply, the reason that you get zero mode is this TR single index theorem that guarantees this existence of zero mode. Yeah, I think I'm running out of time, so so maybe in next lecture, I will give you a few actual comments about what are the physics of this zero mode. For example, how is it related to a fractional charge? So I can also give you some review articles that study discussed the physics of zero modes. For example, you can check this paper. For this soliton physics. So yeah, let me just end up here. And I can take some questions if there are any.
Yeah, of course. So you said you realized this kind of Hamiltonian from the SSH model?
Yeah.
How do you, so what kind of lattice model is it that gives you this varying mass?
That's a good question. So in reality, the SSH model that describe this polymer is that you also have some extra bosonic degree freedom coupled with your fermions. So those bosonic degree freedom are really just plays a role of the, for example, Hopping, this H prime, right? But it's a dynamical thing. So it comes physically, that comes from the interaction of phonons and your lattice, right? So then, you know, the phonons can distort your lattice and then give you this dimerization. But it's a dynamical thing, meaning that in the end, you get, if it's really distort your lattice, you get a spontaneous Z2 symmetry breaking, right? So you can, that's why you can have either positive mass or negative mass. Both of them are degenerate. Then you can, in reality, they can form dynamically, right? You get positive mass and negative mass, and that's why here this soliton can really move, right, without costing energy. Right? Yeah, and then you get those solitons and.
To make sure that I understood, you said that we cannot add these mass terms to our, because they would break translation invariance.
But then, in reality, you the system could break translation symmetry due to some other effect, like what I said, this photon comes from photons, mm-hmm. and then you can play with the physics, then there would be interesting physics related to when you have mass for the Dirac fermions.
Okay, so the big picture is, initially we thought that we couldn't have any massive theory that had a gapless, any massive gapless theory, but then we said that if you do some things like that, then you can actually have it, right?
Yeah.